It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer in the second half hour. The second half of my conversation, perhaps you caught the first part of my conversation with David Axelrod last week in the second half of this show. The second half of that, he is a former senior advisor to President Obama. And in the second half, he'll share some reflections on his first meeting with President Obama and the first campaigns he went through with him. But before that, much of the discussion about rape these days focuses on the influence of drugs, alcohol, and the culture on college campuses. However, an unusual case here in Iowa receiving national attention asks a much different question. When is a previously consenting spouse who is suffering from dementia no longer able to say yes to sex? After a four-year battle with Alzheimer's, Donna Lou Rahons died in a nursing home last August. She was just a few days shy of her 79th birthday. A week later, her husband, Henry Rahons, was arrested. He was charged with sexual abuse. State prosecutors accuse him of having sex with his wife while she was incapacitated by dementia. Rahons is a 9-term Republican state legislator here in Iowa. He decided not to seek another term after this arrest. Rahons' trial, which began last week, is rare and possibly unprecedented in its examination of a little explored aspect of consent. Joining me this half hour to talk about some of the issues involved, Emily Wenzel, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of Iowa, and Kitty Buchwalter, co-director of the National Health Law and Policy Resource Center at the University of Iowa College of Law. She's also Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa College of Nursing. Kitty Buchwalter, Emily Wenzel, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start by turning to you, Emily, as an anthropologist. Reactions I've had from people hearing about this story. That's why I'm turning to you as an anthropologist, first of all. A sad case and one that brings discomfort to a lot of people who learn about it. What issues is it bringing to light for you that you find most interesting?
Well, I think there's a set of social justice issues and then a set of cultural issues. For the social justice issues, this is really happening at the intersection of two rights movements, the fight against sexual assault, so the freedom from unwanted sexual contact, but also the fight for disability rights, the idea that even though you are a person with a disability, even though you have a diagnosis like Alzheimer's, you get to be a full person, including having sex if you want to. So in this case, those things are really at odds. The cultural issues are stigmatization of sex in older age at all, sex among people with disabilities, including things like Alzheimer's, and an institutional culture of lack of privacy and of sort of losing people's personhood and just sort of denying them the ability to have things like sex.
Mm-hmm. So personhood is an interesting word there. You see, Kitty Buchwalter, when we talk about personhood, we talk about decision making and the right to decide for yourself what you want and don't want. Can you tell me a little bit about the effects of dementia on decision making?
Yes, I can. certainly, dementia is a loss of mental abilities due to actual damage of brain cells. A number of domains can be impaired: intelligence, memory, attention, language, reasoning and problem solving, speed of processing, and decision-making abilities. But what I think is important to know is that it's not a one-size-fits-all. Different people experience these losses in different ways over time. And also there can be a fluctuation in the ability to understand and respond and consent from hour to hour or day to day. So there are so many complex factors that enter into trying to determine if somebody has capacity to consent.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to some testimony from yesterday. This is Dr. John Brady. He served at the care facility in Donna's last days as a physician and on the stand at the courthouse in Garner, Iowa, where this trial is taking place. He said that it was his determination that Donna's dementia had become too severe. Let's listen to a few of his words.
She had showed severe cognitive impairment. So along with my clinical visits, nurses' statements, and this all in a combined, that's how I made my determination that I do not feel she would have the mental capacity to consent for sex.
So he says he does not feel she had the mental capacity to consent for sex, which raises the question, how can anyone determine whether a person with dementia can say yes to sex?
Well, first and foremost, I think the person should be asked, do you want to and I know that they did administer at least one standardized test of mental capacity, the brief interview of mental status, which is a test that measures recall and orientation. But it doesn't measure whether somebody wants to enjoy continuing sexual relationships with their husband. There are other factors to consider. Is the person's history such that they have enjoyed sexual relationships and want to continue? Do they know who the person is? And that's a whole other separate issue in a lot of nursing homes where a spouse of one person becomes attracted to someone else.
In the testimony and reporting on this, there are some indications of, I want to ask you about that test in just a moment, but reported that Mrs. Rahans could not recall her daughter's names, could not recall such thing as how to eat a hamburger. And one day, she tried to wash her hands in the toilet of a restaurant bathroom. So there is some indication of the advanced stage of dementia here. But tell me a little bit more about BIMS, this test that goes into determining the degree of dementia a person
has. So the BIMS, which stands for the Brief Interview for Mental Status, is a short screen for one's mental status. It includes repetition of three words, sock, blue, and bed. And then there's scoring based on the number of words that one is able to recall after a specified amount of time. And there are also questions related to temporal orientation. Where are you? What day of the week is this? What month are we in right now? And what year are we in right now? Quite frankly, there are days when I couldn't tell you what day of the week it is myself. But that's due to other factors of the dementia, I hope. So that's basically, and she scored, it's my understanding, a zero on that, meaning that she definitely, the dementia had definitely interfered with her mental status. But one would have to wonder, did it in fact make her incapable of a decision about sexual relationships with her husband? And what I don't know, because my understanding of this case is based solely on what's in the media and not any trial transcripts or anything, was there documentation in the nursing notes about her behavior after the alleged assault? Was she agitated, frightened, crying out for help, or was she calm and pleasant? And so those kinds of behavioral responses would be as important to me in making a determination of consent or not as whether she could recall sock, ball, and blue.
Mm-hmm. During our conversation, we're going to be talking about this another 10 or 15 minutes. Have you perhaps been involved in a decision-making of a loved one with dementia? What obstacles or tough decisions did you face? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can also go to our Facebook page, pose your question there or make your comment, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Emily Wenzel, talk a little bit about the two aspects a little further that you mentioned at the outset here, what you find interesting.
Yeah, well, so first I was talking about how this idea of affirmative consent being imperative for sexual contact really came out of a justice struggle, right, against sexual assault. And this idea of affirmative consent is incredibly useful for anyone who doesn't have a cognitive disability. Where it sort of stops being as useful is, what if you're a person who, because of a cognitive disability, can't give consent in the legal sense? You're not considered qualified to sign a contract, say. Does that mean then you also don't get to experience a range of human experience? You should, if you have a cognitive disability, be equally free from sexual assault, yet able to consent. And so the cultural stuff I was talking about before really comes in then. Because culturally speaking, You know, Americans are kind of freaked out by sex among the aged. We talk about sex constantly, but we're not a sex-positive culture. We talk about sex in terms of fear and concern and worries.
We're not a sex-positive culture.
I would say definitely not.
Mm-hmm. What would be a sex-positive culture? Do we have examples in the world?
Oh, yeah, lots of them. I've lived in Scandinavian countries, for example, where people have very different ideas about sex. People are, I would say, equally interested in sex and talking mm-hmm. about sex, but not so much in policing sex, which doesn't mean they don't have problems with sexual assault and sexual violence. But the idea that older people would have sex is seen as a positive thing. The idea that people might work in a sex industry is seen as a positive thing if you have good legal work protections. So sex isn't stigmatized mm-hmm. in the same kinds of ways that it is in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Go on with your further thought with that, talking about consent among and the elderly.
Yeah, so the question becomes, if consent, you know, verbal consent is our best way of telling, does someone want to do something, but then you get to a group of people who don't have the capacity to give that, does that mean they then don't get to do things like have sex that can be comforting, psychosocially positive, and good? And so I would sort of advocate for a bit of a cultural shift around that. There are some nursing homes and care institutions that have sort of a sexual rights policy, they call it, when they use not the same kinds of sort of legalistic consent that you would be able to give or not based on the BIMS test, but they use things like a person's affect, their answer to direct questions, just like Kitty was saying, do they want to have sex, mm-hmm. Whether they can answer verbally or non-verbally. They actually have policy based on what the people have said they wanted in the past and how they're acting now to determine that.
Mm-hmm. Now, also in testimony yesterday from the trial, Dr. John Brady, we heard him just a few moments ago, medical director of the Concord Care Center in Garner, Iowa, where Donna Lou Rahans spent her final days, testified that while Donna Rahans may have responded, and this is going to what you said, Emily, may have responded positively to her husband's hugs and kisses, that doesn't prove she was mentally capable of consenting to sex. I wonder your thoughts on that, Kitty Buckwalter, if what we have to go on is responding positively to someone's hugs and kisses. Can that be part of a decision in your mind?
Well, I suppose it could be. An important factor to consider is that in dementia, people have different types of changes in their sexuality. Some prefer not to have any sort of sexual relationships or touching at all. Others want to continue relationships that they've enjoyed in the past, and yet others can become hypersexual. So, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all
right.
diagnosis. And the broader issue of concern here is that once somebody is given a diagnosis, even severely impaired, that they stop being recognized as being in control of their decisions, and we start talking to others about what should happen to them. So,
we do that with people who are suffering mentally in terms of their financial status. We don't
absolutely.
Want them to be looted of their money or their family's money. So we make protections. How is that perhaps different or not different?
Well, I think the most important thing, and certainly financial exploitation of older adults, especially those who are cognitively impaired or intellectually disabled, is a huge issue. The most important issue here in all of this is protection of the rights of the person with dementia, in this case, Donna Rahans.
Mm-hmm. No matter what degree of dementia.
That's right.
You have, when you say rights, I'm just wondering if rights are something that kind of dim as the personhood dims, as the dementia takes away that person. Emily, your thoughts?
I would say culturally that's what we see happening. And I think that's what Kitty's sort of critiquing here, right? That, yeah, culturally, absolutely. Once you really get older in general, once you have a certain diagnosis, once you have cognitive impairment, you do lose your right to full personhood. However, I would say that that's a problem, right? That decreases someone's quality of life. That decreases their rights. And I would say that signing, say, a legal contract, you know, can you sell your house when you have advanced Alzheimer's, is different from do you want this flavor of ice cream when you have advanced Alzheimer's. And I would put sex with someone the person has constantly shown and said they enjoy having sex with in the do you want this ice cream or not category of decision making rather than the legal contract category.
So the burden of proof is, you're absolutely right, Emily, differs whether you want to have the capacity to drive a car or give away the family farm, consent to new medication or surgical procedure. I am not aware of any measures that people agree on for determining consent and capacity to have sex. Now, there may be one out there, but I'm certainly not aware.
So this is a precedent-setting case from what you can tell, Kitty.
Well, it is, but also in the sense that of the criminal charges being being filed, which really make it unique. And I think it will have a lot of repercussions clinically and in healthcare systems and in the legal capacity. And when we're talking about protection of rights, it's both sides. Protection of her right not to be sexually abused and protection of her right to enjoy sex and to have love and that sort of thing. If that's what she still wants.
Talk about the implications you see depending on how this case is decided, if there is a conviction or not. What do you see in the industry? Why would people be taking notice? What would they be doing? Stricter guidelines in care facilities? Letting adult children know more clearly what their policies are?
Absolutely. I think too often facilities don't have clear-cut policies. Family are not informed of what those policies are. Now, that it sounds like there was involvement in a care plan where the husband was informed of the decision made by the staff and the daughters. But I think it's going to raise awareness of this issue in a way that perhaps nothing else could in such a timely and significant way.
And I'd predict in negative ways also, right? Because they're really care facilities are generally under-resourced. So when people see this case, I think they're not going to think, okay, we need to spend all this time and money developing a sexual rights policy and really getting to know the people who live here so we can tell if they're giving affirmative consent, even
training
though they're nonverbal.
Yeah.
No, they're going to say, we have to police this extra hard.
Mm-hmm. Emily Wenzel is with us, anthropologist. Another 5 minutes of this conversation at the University of Iowa. Kitty Buckwalter is professor emeritus at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, also has a position at the University of Iowa College of Law. We're talking about the case of Henry Rahons, a 78-year-old who has been charged with third-degree felony sexual abuse, accused of having sex with his wife in a nursing home in May of last year, 8 days after staff members there told him they believed she was mentally unable to agree to have sex or agree to sex. Quick call from Mickey. We don't have much time. Mickey in Des Moines, what's on your mind as we talk about this case?
Hi. I haven't followed this real closely because it's upsetting to me. It's distressing. For example, when my grandmother was put into that higher level care, and she found, and the man found her, that they were very affectionate toward one another, and they would sneak into each other's rooms at night. My mother advocated for a double bed in one of their rooms just to prevent accidents of them, one or the other, falling out of bed and being injured.
Mm-hmm. You were thinking she should not have that decision or that right?
Oh, my grandma should have had that right. Even though she wasn't clear exactly who the man was, she had been divorced in the 50s. She should have had that right and access to at least touch another person and sleep together.
Mm-hmm.
I have another friend whose wife had MS, was nonverbal through her latter years, and her husband would still go to bed with her and have sexual relationships. He wasn't always comfortable because she could not give consent. My other just reminder is that we used to sterilize children with mental retardation. I used to work with those people as adults. Those adult children regretted that their parents made that decision for them. I think access, you know, I don't think this topic should be in a public venue. But it's embarrassing for the senator. But I do believe that regardless, I've not grown that old, and I don't know what my needs will be, but I hope they include a need for affection.
You know, the caller makes a very important point that dementia doesn't necessarily rob people of their desire or need for intimacy and touch and so forth. And sometimes we forget that.
Thank you, Mickey, for sharing some personal reflections and experiences there. Thank you very much. Calling from Des Moines. We have a couple. We have a couple minutes left here to have you mention something you haven't yet, Emily. Do you think then this is developing? What do you see happening in the future as an anthropologist here in the United States when we look at disability rights and the elderly and sex coming in the future?
Disability rights has had a tricky road in the U.S., a very, very tricky road. I think the fight against sexual assault that I mentioned before is doing better, although there is still a long, long, long way to go. As you were saying in the intro, the problem on college campuses demonstrates. So there's a long way to go, but there's this discussion that this is a problem. Disability rights isn't even at that stage yet. A lot of people who haven't experienced these issues firsthand don't think, oh, it's a problem for people who don't have sort of the body that society considers normal to not have the same rights. It's just not something we think of. So I think that has to really become a part of the national conversation for us to be able to deal in a humane and appropriate way with the issues of people who don't conform to norms and so can't consent, say, in the typical ways.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, Kitty Buckwalter here, we have to ask, you know, if there was a conviction of this 78-year-old man, the purpose it would serve?
Well, I'm not sure. That under Iowa law, and this is, I'm not an attorney, but this is information provided by my colleague, Professor Josephine Gittler at the College of Law. There are five well-established justifications for criminal punishment: specific deterrence, incapacitation, rehabilitation, general deterrence, which means preventing Mr. Rahons from going out and raping other people in nursing homes, and retribution, which is punishment. So one would have to ask, what's the value?
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Kitty Buckwalter, co-director of the National Health Law and Policy Resource Center at the University of Iowa College of Law, professor emeritus at the University of Iowa College of Nursing, and Emily Wenzel, assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Iowa. Emily and Kitty, thank you for coming in and talking about
this.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll listen to the second half of my conversation with David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.